In 1874, the British government passed a series of laws called the Regulation of Public Worship. A lot of people cared an awful lot about church back then.
True.
On one side, people wanted more ritual and ceremony.
Order.
On the other side, they wanted mostly none.
Yeah.
In the midst of the battle, one minister, a rector in London at a church called St. George in the East, had stopped a practice whereby people who volunteered in church services could avail themselves of liquor from the rector's cupboard before and after the service. The Reverend King closed the cupboard. We have opened it again. Welcome to the rector's cupboard.
Order!
If you grew up in a particular time in the evangelical church, you may remember the name Mike Warnke. Not everybody does, but those who do right now are going, oh yeah, right. Mike Warnke was a traveling speaker, and he had something, and you'll know this word as well, he had what's called a testimony. Now, in the evangelical church, we were told that everybody had a testimony, but Mike Warnke really had a testimony because his story was that he had been like a Satanist high priest or something, or a high priest in the Church of Satan. And he would go around to churches and other places where the evangelical church would meet and tell his story as kind of an invitation to faith. However, you know where this is going. It turns out that Mike Warnke's testimony was a lie. It wasn't true. In how testimonies are evaluated, that might not have mattered because Mike Warnke, in going around telling this story that wasn't his, was, in the mind of many people, effective in helping, here's another evangelical term, leading people to Jesus. So we talk about this right now, or I'd mention this to you, because when I came across a book, one of the books of our guests today on Rector's Cupboard, I thought back to the time when testimony in my life was a word that I was much more familiar with. Richard Lisher from Duke Divinity School has written a book that came out last year. It's called Our Hearts Are Restless, The Art of Spiritual Memoir. And one of the things that struck me when I read it, and I really recommend it because it's a really, really good book, looking at the stories, the life, the memoir of about 20 people throughout history, their spiritual memoir. It struck me as I read the book that this spiritual memoir was very different than testimony in a way that helped kind of continue to relieve me from some of those negative associations of the past. Lisher in his book says, I think it's in the introduction, says, some lives are construed as if lived in the presence of God. And then he goes on to talk about a number of different people, some very well known, some much less so, some where the memoir is not about any kind of span of their life at all, but just maybe a vision or a series of visions, and others who tell the story of their life. It's a great book, and it has, I think, some healing and positive implications for how we consider our own lives and the lives of those we love. So we're really pleased for this conversation, flattered that Richard Lisher agreed to come on and speak with us about this book, and highly recommend the book. Enjoy the conversation. So Richard, or Rick, you said we could call you Rick, and it was great to visit you when we were in North Carolina as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be here.
So we'll start by asking kind of the setting question. The book, Our Hearts Are Restless, The Art of Spiritual Memoir, which I loved. It's a fantastic book that I recommend to anybody. But there is a distinction in this book between simply autobiography or memoir or testimony. So can you tell us what is spiritual memoir? What particularly sets it apart from some of these other ways of speaking about a life?
I should say that I began even thinking about memoir versus autobiography when I wrote a couple of memoirs myself. Mm. I wrote a memoir of my first parish, my first experience in ministry as a very young person, and also a memoir of my son and his death, mm-hmm. that was published some years ago now. Memoir, as I understand it, is an inflected point or a memory of an inflection point in a life after which some change occurs. It may be a new appreciation or a new faithfulness, a new understanding of the self, or in Christian terms, a new understanding of God. And it may even be a conversion to belief. An inflection point is the point on a curved line, the point at which the line begins to take a different direction, which I think makes sense when you think of it in literary terms. It's different from an autobiography in this way. The autobiography attempts to narrate an entire life, childhood experiences, teachers, everything that one can include about one's life, whereas a memoir is a kind of lancet window, a very narrow beam of light shed on one period of life or one theme or one experience. I think, for example, of the American writer Reynolds Price, who wrote three autobiographies tracing his development as a person and as a writer, but only one memoir. And the memoir was about only one thing, and that was his paraplegia. Or you can think of C.S. Lewis, who wrote an autobiography, Surprised by Joy, and what wrote only one memoir. And that memoir had to do with one subject, and that was his own grief at the death of his wife, a grief observed. So in my case, the memoirs that I wrote, one was strictly about a 2.5 to 3 year period of time when I was learning how to be a pastor in a tiny little Lutheran church out in southern Illinois, out on the plains. And the other was about one particular inflection point, namely the death of a beloved son, after whom new experience, after which new experiences and new understandings were definitely formed. So that's the basic difference. A memoir is really a series of reappraisals. Writer looks back at his or her life and tries to inhabit a person and a psyche and a language that may have occurred many years before, and then reproduces it, but reproduces it with a certain attitude toward the value of that life. I did a presentation yesterday to a group about this memoir I wrote about my first ministry when I was about 28 years old. And I reminded the group I wrote this memoir when I was 57 years old. I was no longer a pastor of a church, but I was a professor in a university. And now I'm talking to you about it, I said, when I am, let us say, considerably older than 57.
That's well,
Things are not set in stone.
Well, and memory becomes such a part of it too, then, right?
Of course.
You have this line, I think it's in the introduction to in the book. You say some lives are construed as if lived in the presence of God. I mean, that's to some degree that the spiritual part of the spiritual memoir. But there's just something in there that for me was such an invitation into a deeper consideration and a deeper reflection to the presence of about the presence of God than say how I sometimes, so I'm not seeking to castigate a whole genre here, but how I have sometimes heard the word like testimony, particularly in say like an evangelical church setting where it's like give your testimony. That sounds so different and so much smaller to me than some lives are construed as if lived in the presence of God. What were you hoping? What were some of the things that you were hoping in that spiritual aspect of memoir to communicate to readers? Or what did you hope they would hold?
I think you're right in observing that living, as the theologians used to call it, coram Deo, in the presence of God, is about as broad a category of spiritual memoir are as broad a description of spiritual memoir as you can imagine. Certainly, a spiritual memoir can be a testimony. And in fact, spiritual memoir as a practice of the church grew out of things like spiritual testimonies or confessions or doxologies and the like. But Coram Deo, in the presence of God, is sort of the baseline of a spiritual memoir because it acknowledges that we are creatures and that we're not on our own out here, but we are always, no matter what we're doing, testifying, sinning, regretting, praising, whatever we're doing, dying, all of it is done because we are creatures of God, created by him, and then Christians would add, and redeemed by him.
Yes.
So it's a really broad way, and it came to me right away as the way to think about spiritual memoir.
Yeah, it holds the book together so well. I'm also thinking of the time in which you're writing and the time in which myself and other readers are reading. You mentioned there's so many books like this right now that I've read, and it feels like, you know, the times we look back to the pandemic, the plague, and now you're, you know, we're reading a lot of books, seeing television shows or movies or whatever that have been made after the pandemic. And so they're referencing back to the time or something. And in the introduction, you mentioned that a good portion of your writing of this book was during that time. I think you use the term shakiness or something, that there is a shakiness. And you clearly have in your mind as you're writing the sense that spiritual memoir can do something into that shakiness, can offer, I guess, some sense of stability or
right.
It is interesting now because you wrote that then, not being able to anticipate where you would be now. But I think, I don't think it's that controversial to say there's still a shakiness, or maybe even a greater shakiness from that time. Like, we haven't come out and felt, most people, a sense of really solid ground. It seems like many of the things we take for granted are shaky. So what do you think spiritual memoir offers in times like that, in times where there's just this lack of a sense of stability?
Right. I noticed you used the word shaky a few times. It made me think of Paul Tillich's book written in, I guess, in the early 50s or late 1940s, The Shaking of the Foundations. We're certainly not the first generation to experience the shaking of the foundations. Those who went through the war years, First and Second War, or the Civil War, those who went through an earlier pandemic, like Dorothy Day, who I write about in the book. And I noticed as I was writing about her and others that many of the people I treat in Our Hearts Are Restless were writing out of a sense of great disruption, either socially or personally. I mean, literally, Dorothy Day was writing just after, or after she had just experienced the great pandemic of 1920, 1918, 20, the so-called Spanish flu, when she herself lost her bearings. She decided she would no longer be a journalist. She wasn't going to write. She was going to be a nurse, and which was an occupation for which she was ill-suited. And she quit in a kind of vocational despair. People who are not sure that they are living in the presence of God will have a kind of perpetual shakiness that they may never admit. And some have felt that and are writing about it. When somebody is writing about the death of someone very dear to them, we've heard people say, my whole world is shattered.
Yeah.
It's not like saying this is a bad experience. And so I think COVID really brought that to a head for us. And it is still, we are still feeling the effects of COVID in our personal and especially in our church lives. It did its work to destroy community. And to create great distrust among people We saw that with all the debates, so acrimonious in nature over whether or not we should get a vaccine, and get an inoculation that might prevent further suffering. So, what happens here is that people are sort of adrift, and they need some sort of assurance. Some sort of port they can turn into, no matter even if it is a literary port. And of course, when you can't go out and meet people and you're limited to your own apartment or your own house where you're living, you tend to read. And I think that the personal memoir, and especially the spiritual memoir written by someone who is living in the presence of God, can be a kind of anchor. It's not the only solution, of course, to the loneliness and disruption of life, but it's something. And we're suffering from a plague of loneliness right now that has been recognized not only at the social level, but even at the political level. In England, they've established a minister of loneliness, someone whose whole portfolio is to try to help this terrible plague of loneliness that is besetting so many people. Loneliness meets up with a spiritual memoirist who says, "This is how I hit bottom," or "This is how I felt my world was shaking apart, and this is the path I took. It won't be the exact same path that you take, but this is the path I took." And so there is a kind of meeting of the minds, a kind of a spiritual intimacy that occurs in spiritual memoir, unlike, I think, many other genres, including fiction.
Yeah, I picture that sitting. I can picture sitting in a chair, like that some of us have particular chairs we read in more or something that, and I like that you use the term shakiness and offer us a sense of stability, or that this can be that a literary port, because I think many of us can actually think almost like a physical feeling. It's spiritual, it's mental, it's emotional, but a feeling calmed in the company of reading something like that. And you also mentioned the perpetual shakiness in terms of not having that kind of, we would say, anchor of faith or something that many people can point to. I recall, and I'm just thinking of this as we talk, as you mentioned that, the author who's local to our part of the world here, to Vancouver, Douglas Copeland, who coined the term Generation X, right? Because he wrote that book. And when was that? Like late 90s? 90s or something. But anyway, he has a little book called Life After God that's not spiritual memoir because it's fiction, but it's a bit of spiritual memoir because it's pieces of his life. He's just a kind of weird writer. But the end, I don't know if you know the work, but the end is this, and he's not writing as a person of Christian faith or something like that. It's not a spiritual memoir in that regard, though to some degree it is, because the very end, the summation of the book is, he basically says, "In the end, all I can tell you is this," and he pictures he's out camping somewhere here on the west coast of Canada. This is how he's right. All I can he sets this image of being in the rain in a tent, and all I can tell you is this, he says, "I need God." And that's kind of like this very end of this book. It became quite well known in evangelical circles because people, said, Douglas Copeland, this, really famous writer, he needs God too. Maybe you should pray the prayer now or something. But there is this, there is, I think that's the right term, intimacy. And even that expression, if you don't believe or can't believe, feel you can't believe, of course, and to say that you do would be, I suppose, dishonest. Teresa of Lisieux, you have, well, there's many chapters in this, like there's, I can't remember how many people, you might know the number, but chapter after chapter is story after story of spiritual memoir of a person. You talk about Teresa of Lisieux, and the word that stands out for me is little, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, but there is this line that, from what we're talking about here, that she has that you bring up, where she says, "I am going to entrust to you the story of my soul." That, I think, right? I could hear you see it. That speaks to that intimacy. That is so wonderful. You've structured the book, though, and what, again, I'm going to just keep praising the book. There is a structure to it, but it's the structure doesn't hurt it. Like, you know, you and I have both read so many books where you're like, oh, it's all structure and no
Yeah,
heart.
right.
You know, like,
Yeah.
there is a structure to it. You mentioned you call them seven plots, and even if you don't get to all seven, what are some of the seven of those plots of a spiritual memoir? And I think people will recognize some of them that you name.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. I would like to go back just a
Absolutely.
bit to backtrack on some things we've been talking about intimacy, which is really part and parcel of the genre of memoir, and especially the spiritual memoir. And I could testify myself, having written a book about the death of a child, about the really intense encounters I've had with readers who have experienced the same thing. And
So people have messaged
our
you.
meeting of the minds and souls has taken place because of a literary reading, because of something literary. So it is possible that these meetings have been facilitated by a literary genre and somebody who is willing to write in a way that seems to have been listening to the needs of others. And the same with Teresa of Lisieux. I mentioned somewhere in the book that that is probably the most open, personal, trusting, intimate first line of a memoir that I've ever read.
Oh,
I
that's
mean,
the
you know, that's
first
the first
line, right?
line. You know, Augustine's first line in the Confessions is, God, you are great. And Teresa says, I'm going to give you my life. You know, so there are different ways to do this. Now, you mentioned these seven paths that I talk about. This is somewhat of an artificial construction, and I certainly didn't want to push it to the point that, as you say, the reader gets a little sick of it.
You
And
don't
I'm
push
sure
it.
there are other paths, but the paths I wrote about are the most obvious one is the first one, search and surrender. That's Augustine and that's Thomas Merton and a lot of others who dedicate a good portion of their lives to searching for some meaning, some truth. And it's not just any truth, but it's a truth that they believe they can live by and that will absolutely transform their lives, that will make them new people. But finally, when you find it, it's like that old slogan from the 1970s, I've found it, which of course is highly inaccurate because when you finally find it, you see the irony that you have been found, that you didn't find it, but finally something, namely God, has broken through to you. And so, and what can you do before that kind of love but surrender?
So
You
well put.
don't meet it on, you know, on the same plane or the same level and say, okay, now God, we're partners. No, you surrender to something so magnificent and so far above anything you have ever embodied in your life. There is no other possible response but to get on your knees. You know, somebody said when Socrates would walk into a room, if Socrates were to walk in a room, everybody would stand in respect. If Jesus were to walk in a room, everybody would kneel. So anyway.
That's so well put. I'm going to jump in and read a line from the book or a
Okay.
quote. It's in the little section I had on Augustine questions, because it just is highlights what you just said. He, Augustine, ruefully notes the discrepancy between what he thought he was achieving and what God was accomplishing in him. It's the irony of a man who thought he was seeking and finding when in fact he was being found.
Right.
This is it's so well put. Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, that is the fundamental irony of religious autobiography and memoir. And Augustine, of course, is not the only person to have noticed this. I think C.S. Lewis noticed it. Thomas Merton noticed it. Dorothy Day noticed it. In my chapter on Kathleen Norris, the spiritual writer who's still with us and has enriched so many people with her memoirs, she writes in one of them, and I think it's maybe The Cloister Walk. She says, you know, the very things, I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not as eloquent as she is, the very things that were messing me up and ruining my life became the occasions for God to change my life. And so, you know, she went through a good portion of her life bemoaning the aimlessness and the recklessness of her life. And finally, by getting into that restlessness that Augustine talks about, and finally notices, hey, God is the author of this restlessness. It's not just me churning around, but it's God churning me around, churning and then turning. If you pardon the pun.
Yeah, it's so, that's the first one, Search and Surrender.
The first
yeah,
one.
Yeah, there's more.
And a couple of others. One is Revelations. And I wanted to point out in this book that not all the action in spiritual memoirists occurs where you can see it on the streets or in community. A lot of it occurs in their heads. And Julian of Norwich and her is one example of that, who saw a lot of things and then basically wrote to tell about what she saw. And she tells it in narrative form, and narrative is what makes a memoir. Another has to do, one of the chapters I call How Goes the Battle, and that's John Bunyan, who is battling against his own conversion. Even the most pious reader gets tired of watching John Bunyan change his mind. I counted about 30 times in which he got converted and then unconverted about a page later. But finally it sticks. I think the section of the book that is most remarked upon is the one I call the stripping of the altar. And that is the various stories of people like Abelard and Bonhoeffer and Eddie Hillison and C.S. Lewis and so forth, who sort of write from the bottom. And they forswear what I call the additive benefits of being a Christian, which is, for most people, happiness or success or better ratings on your program or whatever it might be. They don't write in those terms at all, because they find God and celebrate God where they are at the bottom rung. And that is their message. And the stripping of the altar, of course, refers to practices in some churches where on Maundy Thursday, the paraments are taken off the altar, all the decorations are taken away from the altar, the flowers, the Bible, everything. And it's taken down to either bare wood or stone, which becomes then a metaphor of two things. It's a metaphor of what happened to Jesus, who was literally stripped. And for all the world to see, stripped of his divinity, stripped of his authority, and totally humbled. And it's what happens to those who are in the church, who are watching this, or who are reflecting on the ways in which their altars have been stripped and in which they have been taken down to bare wood or stone. And the gospel in this is you can be taken down that low and find God. And there are writers who write in that vein, and they are, I think, great contributors to their readers and to me.
Yeah, the Eddie Hillison, you mentioned the chapter. I can't remember how I came across, I mean, anybody who reads, particularly in kind of Christian tradition, and I think eventually we'll find some of these similar things. So I don't remember who it was or where I had it recommended first, but I remember reading the book An Interrupted Life and Letters from Westerbork a number of years ago. And it is one of those books that just, some of its descriptions, like, they stay with me. They come back, not necessarily daily, but over and over and over again. And it comes from this. She is the beginning of it, and I'm probably not giving it a fair reading. You can kind of correct it or whatever. The beginning, I remember, seemed almost self-indulgent. She's talking about, she's a young woman living in Europe, you know, the rise of National Socialism, the Nazi Party is kind of expanding its grip, getting closer and closer to her. Jewish faith, interest in Christian faith as well. But the beginning is her writing about her lovers and such, and this kind of, and I remember thinking, like, well, I'm reading this young woman's diary. She seems, I guess, ahead of her time, but that's kind of my time self-centeredness in a way.
Yeah, she has this one line from this early part in her diary, which she says, I am erotic in all directions.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly how it runs, is it's just this kind of like, do I need to keep reading this? But then just step by step, you see this, darkness coming closer, and then the way that she writes, I want to read it. It's a little bit of a, this quote, she's talking about a colleague of hers, not a Nazi. She said, the most striking thing about him is his inflexible, rigid neck. He hates our persecutors with an undying hatred, presumably with good reason. But he himself is a bully. He would make a model concentration camp guard. When I saw him walking about among the others with his rigid neck and imperious look and his ever-present short pipe, I always thought all he needs is a whip in his hand. It would suit him to perfection. But I still never hated him. I found him much too fascinating for that. Now and then, I felt terribly sorry for him. She, just exactly what you're saying, and of course she dies. She's murdered at Auschwitz. Yeah. And I don't have it with me, but the other image that strikes me, I almost sometimes don't like looking up the quote, I guess because of that intimacy or something. She writes in similar way that she's written what I've just read. She writes about seeing an actual guard. And she cast this person, I think, if I'm remembering it correctly, as someone who would kill her. But what she writes is feeling sorry for him, as if she's just going to die.
Yeah.
But she hasn't lost her awareness or her sense of humanity. I guess it moves a question from that is, how does spiritual memoir, and maybe it's from Stripping of the Altar or these, you could refer to some other ones, help us to see humanity and inhumanity more vividly? So it's spiritual, it's in the presence of God, but what it's helping you to see is the humanity of another person.
Spiritual memoir is not simply a religious paean to God. If it's a narrative, it has all the demands that are placed upon narrative, which is a certain realism, a certain way of looking at evil in the world and not sugarcoating it, because then you make of God's redemption sort of a sentimental act. You know, you've got to get down to bare bone, and that's, you know, you got to get down to bare wood or bare bone. And that's what Eddie Hillesum is able to do, but she's able to do it in a way that does not hate.
Yes.
When she describes
this
guard, he's not a guard, he's the commandant of the whole operation.
Okay.
Walking around so full of his own authority, and he's got an assistant following him around, and he's got a big dog that he carries on his leash, and the assistant, to make matters even worse, is a prisoner who has found favor with the commandant. And what he's doing is he's walking through a crowd of these poor, miserable prisoners, selecting those who will go to Auschwitz and those who will not. And that day he does his job. And I have never read, I can't say I'm a great expert in this form of literature, but I have never read a more piercing
Yes, exactly.
description of this kind of event
Exactly, yeah.
as she does. And I think what makes it piercing is that she is at this point simply an eye looking at it. This is just her vision of what she is seeing, and she is recording it without hatred at all, just as if to say the banality
Yes.
of this man's arrogance and pride, I don't have to condemn. All I have to do is show it to you.
Ah,
And
so
to my way of
nice.
thinking, she is showing herself to be a marvelous writer and a marvelous narrator of the human experience and human nature when she writes about that person. It is very memorable, and it ends with the train pulling out
Yeah.
of the station with a couple of thousand Jews heading toward Auschwitz, which later, of course, she herself would be a part of. And you speak about her death,
Yeah.
and in a sense, it's like thinking about Bonhoeffer's death. There are no actual letters from hell. We don't see them at the very end, just as we don't see many other victims of the concentration camps. They are not writing just at the moment in which they are giving their lives. So, in a sense, they're just sort of disappearing into darkness. And that's all we can say about them, other than the way they approach that darkness. And you're right
Yes.
to say she was pretty self-indulgent, but she always seems to have believed that she had some amazing purpose for her life. I mean, I've known people like that. I've known kids like that,
Yeah.
who just from the very
Yeah.
earliest time in their lives seem to believe in themselves and believe that they have been appointed to do something. They don't know what exactly, but they've been appointed to do something. And that's the kind of writer she is. And I think when I think back on the people I've written about in 21 chapters, she demonstrates the most spiritual energy
Yeah.
of anyone. And the vibrancy of her style, and she was not a professional writer, but the vibrancy of her style is truly amazing.
Yeah, and it's something so much, not that we want to turn it into like instrumental, but when you mentioned this sense that she had something big to do or something, and yet she died young at Auschwitz, and yet now we're reading this, and I would recommend more people go and read her story, read Richard Lischer's book, but then don't be afraid to read the memoir, the actual memoirs, right?
Of course.
There is something in her writing for our time too, that across this polarization, of course, she almost weeps over the inhumanity of the other, not for her sake, actually, but for theirs. That who is the one who is suffering here? Who is the one who's lost their connection to this? It's absolutely
She is
astounding.
not like Elie Wiesel as a boy, and Elie Wiesel as a man who was an observant Jew. She was an assimilated
Yeah.
Jew, and her family was very much a part of the Gentile community in a way. And yet she never, she has been sometimes claimed as some sort of a Christian convert. She was not that.
That's right, yeah.
She prayed for the Jews,
Yeah.
and she understood in total solidarity with the people who were being sent off to camps. She was Jewish to the core, and yet she read the Gospel of Matthew, and it meant something to her. She meant the Sermon on the Mount, and that was a part of what she deemed her conversion. And her conversion was to God, but also to her fellow humanity. And when she was in the concentration camp, she said, and this is so beautiful, she said, I wish I could be a sacrament to my barracks. I wish I could be a sacrament to my barracks. And when she was being shipped off in these cattle cars toward Auschwitz, she wrote on a postcard and threw it out the window. And it said on the postcard, "We left the camp singing. My God is a high mountain and a holy hill." And she addressed it to her home in the Netherlands. And it was found and taken to her house. Of course, she was dead. And that's how we have that postcard. I mean,
It's almost too
you talk
much.
about a witness,
Yeah.
and you can't overlook the witness character of the best spiritual memoirs. They
Yes.
do not preach, they
Yes.
show. But in the way they show, they witness.
So well put. I to be self-indulgent myself, but it's what I feel is it's almost too much as you describe the Eddie Hillesum stuff. I've been to Auschwitz and was there on a day when it was very, there was almost nobody there. My wife and I were there.
Oh.
The Pope had been there the day before, and some people thought it was closed, and there was this huge thunderstorm as well. And so, in a place that's supposed to be like super crowded all the time, and they say, you know, that's one of the things that's hard to kind of grapple with is the noise, and we were walking around virtually by ourselves. But when you speak of Eddie Hillesum and dying there, it just stays with you, right? Like it is just this kind of, but it's called to something better and more hopeful. I want to touch upon to switch to one. I mean, we won't get anywhere near all of them. There's at least a couple questions, one from Thomas Merton and one from Teresa Lisieux. The Thomas Merton chapter, a couple of friends of mine who've read the book both mentioned the Merton chapter. They just love the Thomas Merton chapter. It has a description of kind of the arc of a religious life. You describe his coming to faith. A light rain is falling. Merton walks the 9 blocks to Corpus Christi to meet a priest. This isn't a direct quote. And then you pick up a line of his memoir when he says, "And then everything inside me began to sing." You then describe this new person, Father Louis. Is it Louis or Louis? Does he? I don't know. Father Louis.
I think it's Lewis.
Okay, Father Louis, a new identity for Thomas, for Tom Merton. So now there's Father Lewis, but you mentioned well, and it's something that those of us who've been in church ministry, church work, evangelical church, you mentioned this looking, Father Lewis looking down on Tom Merton as this kind of, you know, sinful, ignorant. And when I was reading that, I was like, uh-oh, is this going to be like supposedly the good thing? Like, oh, thank God for Father Lewis. Because as someone who is fairly, you know, Christian, but I'm not that religious sometimes, I don't think. And I tend to be like, oh no, the sales packages. So I was worried that Father Lewis would be the hero, but that's not how you
Oh,
mentioned that
no.
Thomas Merton then eventually gets to the place where he sees the kind of zealous nature of Father Lewis in a new light. I think you mentioned that in his middle age, he will renounce not Tom Merton, but Father Lewis. Tell us about
That's
that.
correct.
Yeah, I find that such an interesting arc, that religious life that you know you have a conversion or something, and then you kind of think, oh, I used to be so sinful, but that eventually, hopefully, you'll realize, oh, I see it differently now.
Right. Well, I was mentioning that earlier in our discussion, that when you write about your own life, you have a chance to reappraise your earlier life. And usually when you're doing so, you know a bit more, you're more mature, you're more settled in the world. And so you don't think so much about you don't think that you were all that wonderful when you look back. And that's one of the dangers, I suppose, of even writing this kind of literature. And Merton went through the same thing. There are really three characters built into one Thomas Merton. And there's Tom Merton, who was this young roustabout and fellow, a searcher who traveled the world and wrote poems and did all sorts of things and drank beer and got into trouble at times. And then he converted and he goes into a monastery, and just to symbolize the change of your life, and this is of course well attested to in many religions, you get a new name. And he becomes Father Lewis, and suddenly Father Lewis is very critical, not only of young Tom Merton, but he's critical of everything about Protestantism, women. He doesn't like
Oh,
women
yeah.
at all. And then finally, of course, Thomas Merton didn't stop writing. And he wrote another 7 or 8 volumes of journals. And in his journals, he really turns on Father Lewis. And what he doesn't like about Father Lewis is Merton's his own triumphalism
Yes.
as a new Catholic. I mean, there's sometimes you have to say there's nothing worse than a new Christian or a new Catholic or someone who has stopped smoking. I mean, it's just they can be insufferable. And there is a part at toward the second half of the Seven Story Mountain in which Father Lewis is becoming insufferable. And now Thomas Merton, who has become an activist for peace and openness in the Roman Catholic Church and all the rest, and this great figure in American literature, says about his own character in the Seven Story Mountain, he says, "You know what?" He says, "I don't even know that guy." It's like, who is he? So it's like a hall of mirrors. It's very complex. And finally, the people who get to decide who they like are the readers. And the readers decide. And my guess is that in the Seven Story Mountain, readers are more taken with the first half of that book than the second half. But I'm not sure.
That's an interesting question. It's a very good book, so people could go and see themselves, but I'm really grateful for that, your articulation of that turn. Teresa of Lisieux, this little flower, that word
The
little,
little.
little, and little, and little, she, and you do it so well, she helps us to see that spiritual memoir doesn't mean writing about a life where, like, some great victory has been accomplished, or some, you're a celebrity. She refers to her life as little, and you actually bring out a quote all from her memoir, but I'll read your telling of it. The kinds of things that she's writing about, they just seem so almost not worth writing about. She says she's, you say she's been giving her doctrine of love a trial run by ignoring the slight of a fellow nun who barred her from Mother Gonzaga's room, by showing kindness to another whose teeth chattering annoys her to no end. These are the kind of topics in Teresa of Lisieux's writing. How does, like, ordinariness, littleness, play in spiritual memoir, maybe particularly in reference to her?
I have to say that the theme of little in Teresa of Lisieux, who is a much enormously beloved saint in the church, I somewhere say there are more statues of Teresa of Lisieux in American Catholic churches than any other woman except for the Virgin Mary. It took Joan of Arc about 300 years to become a saint in France, and it took Teresa about 30 years. So there, she caught fire. She was just amazing. And this theme of little is, to maybe a Protestant's eye, a really cloying, irritating kind of trait habit. She has everything is little. I am Jesus's little ball. He can just
Yeah.
kick me around however he wants, and maybe we'll score a goal, but probably not. That kind of thing really gets on your nerves. And she's the one who named herself the little flower. And this I tried to explain in my chapter, comes, I think, from her family, her dad, her father, her older sisters infantilizing her. She became her father's, quote, little queen. And yet she had this iron will and ambition to become a nun and to get admitted to the Carmel, the convent in her town of Lisieux. And you can say about her good works, not being irritated. I mean, she did things like scrub the floors on her hands and knees before the other nuns. She was often humiliated by a very jealous prioress, because no one could match her humility and her piety. And in those early years in the convent, she sort of kept lists of all the ways in which she was good and virtuous, and they became a measure of her Christian self-perfection. She never lost that desire to do little things for people. She called it the little way of kindness, which we could all use, of course. But there was a kind of transfer that took place later in her life, especially as she was dying of tuberculosis at age 24, that the little things she did for others and the little kindnesses she showed were not so much to inflate her own worth, but were being done because she cared about others and truly believed that the little things we do in life are really as saintly as some of the big things that get celebrated. And I pointed out in the book that we shouldn't really, feel pardon the pun, belittle Teresa of Lisieux, because most of us have actually not practiced our Christian faith in public and heroic ways.
That's right.
I have never been
That's right.
put in prison for my
Yeah.
faith. I've never gone to court to defend the poor. I haven't shed all my belongings to follow the way of discipleship. I have a house. I have a pension plan. All those sorts of things. So let's think again about the little way of sainthood. She had always wanted to be a missionary and to be sent to China and far-flung places, but she got tuberculosis. And so she said, I'm going to find a new way, and it's going to be, in keeping with her whole rhetoric of herself, a little way. And that's the only actually use of the word little that I appreciate about Teresa, is that these acts of kindness are little and yet they are valuable. In my book, I compared her little way to some of the parables that Jesus told.
That's right.
And he talked about the kingdom of God and finding the kingdom of God in your village, or in not being mad at your brother, like the widow's mite, giving your last bit into the offering plate. These are not big ways. There's a big way and there's a little way.
So good.
And Jesus was saying, actually, there's only one way, and it's my way. And that's the message of the cross.
Thank you so much.
So she. The other thing I just want to say about Teresa, too, the humanizing thing about Teresa is that she openly admitted in her writing and in her interactions with the Mother Superior and others, that for most of her time in the convent, she herself was in a horrible spiritual depression, a crisis. She said it was as if Jesus just checked out. And she went into the convent the way maybe many enter the religious life, with an exhilarating sense of God's presence in their lives. I'm doing this for God. I'm doing this with God. God is with me. And it was as if Jesus just left by the back door. And she, like her namesake,
That's right.
Teresa of
You mentioned that
Calcutta,
in, yeah.
who talked about the darkness, Teresa of Lisieux was very open in talking about what she called the dryness.
That's it's
And at one
yeah.
point she wrote to her sister, she said, Jesus is asleep in my little boat. He's gone.
Boy, that's a great way of putting it. Hey, I really
And yet,
appreciate that, yeah.
somehow she felt that she could still practice a kind of sainthood in a God who was gone. So, I
Wow,
mean, you're talking about
that is.
a very old-fashioned, middle-class, safe French religious woman. But you're also talking about someone who, in her own odd way, embodies a kind of a spiritual crisis that many people, many of us, feel. That maybe if we go through the motions that God has commanded us, maybe if we go through the liturgy, maybe if we do the Ten Commandments and do the things, maybe suddenly the veil will part. And God will be there again for us too.
That's so well put. I before we close, I want to direct listeners to an interview you did. I actually have the journal right here. I'll hold it up on our call for. It's published in Image Journal, current right now. I don't know what they call it, what edition they call it, number 119. But it's a beautiful interview in Image, and so we'll put a link there. There's a word you use in there. I think it's in the book as well. I'm not even going to pronounce it right. My ignorance is going to come out that I don't know it, and I don't know how to say it. Bildungsroman? What's that? How do I say
Oh,
that?
yeah. Okay, I'll say it. It's German and it's Bildungsroman.
Okay,
And
Bildungsroman.
what it
What
means
is it?
is it's what my two memoirs are and what a lot of religious memoirs are, because they're Christian memoirs are not all conversion stories. Bildungsroman means a novel or a writing of discovery or education.
Thank you.
And so there are those sorts of memoirs in which, and I give myself as an example in my Open Secrets, I am discovering the grace of ministry. What the Germans, I'll hit you with another German word, since I'm sure this will be disseminated widely throughout the German Republic.
Yes, you could be sure of that.
Amtsgnade. It's a word that you kind of spit when you say it. Amtsgnade,
I don't even know what
and
letter
it
to put
means
first.
it's a
Okay, thank you.
office grace.
Okay.
It's office grace, and it's a discovery of the grace that is housed within the office of ministry. And so many people think, well, what are my gifts? What can I bring to the ministry? Forgetting that the ministry is going to reshape you with its own gifts and graces. So the German theologians used to talk about office grace.
That's so good. Actually, I want to ask a question. I'm going to end in a minute with the we always ask what's giving you hope today. So we'll get to that. But this, what you just said, brings out something I had in my thoughts in preparation for this. you talk about spiritual memoir and these people who write to us about like their lives construed in the presence of God, or their, it would seem to me that part of the call of a minister would be to help others do, or I'm not even saying to like tell people where God is in their lives, like not that prescriptive or aggressive, right? But that part of my call as a minister is to seek to be aware of the presence of God in the life of the other person. That this is part of the office, of, not to try to get them to do something or sign up to help at the church or run this right. thing, or but just my friend, you know, Bill so-and-so or whatever. Dear God, let me see your presence, how this person is living their lives, you know, in your presence. How do you see that as a minister, as a professor, as a, I mean, because you obviously have done this with these people, but you must do this in your life with people who haven't written spiritual memoir.
Well, you know, I'm a Lutheran. And one of the things that get pounded into the heads of Lutheran seminarians is when you get into the ministry and you're a pastor, you must be out in the community and you must be in the homes and at the workplaces, and not simply meeting your parishioners on Sunday morning as you shake their hand as they file by and out of the church. And I can't emphasize this enough, and I've tried to talk about this with seminarians, is that you have to be out there, not only in the community as, you know, social activists and community activists, but also in the community of faith, so that you will see where God is at work in the lives of the members of this congregation. And when you see it, and you will see it, yes. and you will see it in a way that shames you.
Yes.
It will build you up and keep you going. That's what will keep you going. When I was a new pastor, I've been a new pastor in two congregations. I was at Duke for nearly 40 years, mm-hmm. but before that, whenever I entered a new community and a new church, I always called on everybody in the church in their home mm-hmm. by appointment in the evening. And I wanted to see them where they lived and where they would talk more freely about themselves and their faith. And I noticed after a while that in every visit, usually just before the coffee cake was brought out and the coffee, no alcohol.
Yeah, those days, yeah.
Somebody in that family would tell me a story of the worst thing that had ever happened to them and how they had gone on, how they lost the farm, how a granddaughter drowned in a pond, mm-hmm. how a son didn't come home from Vietnam, whatever it was. And it was their way of saying, if you don't know this about me, how can you be my pastor? But now that you do, we can go on together. God. And I take that as a kind of metaphor for what can happen in spiritual memoir. I can't say that it always does, but it can happen in spiritual memoir. When you say, this is the path I took, these are the mistakes I made, and this is the grace that found me.
So good. Thank you so much.
But first, you have to close my book and open your own.
Well said. So as we end this point in your writing and work and life, what's giving you hope today? I mean, you just pointed to some of it, but...
What's giving me hope? I sound a little like Teresa of Lisieux. Mm. What gives me hope are the incredible acts of faithfulness that I continue to see everywhere. I'm not going to give a lot of institutional hope at this point. And I wouldn't have, I think, even before COVID. Mm-hmm. But we're still dealing with the loss of the materiality and the corporality the physicalness of being together, and having that substituted by online. We really weren't meant to worship online. We weren't worship meant to receive the Eucharist in our Toyotas. It's so I see hope though in this continuing this conti these continuing acts of caring for one another in the name of Jesus at every level. I'm married to a Stephen minister, and I see how that works, and I also see how that has transformed her and changed her. I mean, there was something that made her want to be a Stephen minister, but now it is having this great effect. And so I see it in that. I see it in I don't see it in politics,
No.
of course, but there is a politics of the poor where Christians are, and in some limited way, speaking out for the poor and the dispossessed in the name of Jesus. I think of a guy like William Barber,
Yep.
who is a
Yep, I know
I
him.
had as a student a long time
Oh, I
ago,
didn't know that.
and I have the greatest respect for what he's trying to do,
Yeah.
and he's, working in the mainstream.
Oh, yeah.
But even greater than that, I see these smaller acts. And I see a willingness on the part of churches to experiment and to create new forms. Just this past weekend, I saw three different churches that it looks like they each one were formerly auto dealerships
Yeah.
or factories or something. They're long, low buildings. And right here in North Carolina, three cities, including Durham, and I've been into one of them in Durham, and it's part coffee shop, it's part study hall, it's part distribution center. On Sundays, it's part worship,
Yeah.
church, it's part library for people who want to come in. It's all these things, they're never in the most affluent
Yeah.
communities, of course. But what they are doing is they are trying, somebody's trying to create a community in Christ.
Well
But
said.
they know that the high steeple, multi-million dollar facility, not only is it not possible, but it may not work.
Right.
So we'll find something that will work. And
That's
you have to let go of all your institutional dreams. And of course, I'm of the generation that you grew up with Protestantism as powerhouse of America.
Yeah.
In 1960, Will Herberg wrote a best-selling book about religion in America, and you know what the title was? Protestant, Catholic, Jew. As if to say, that's all there is. That's American religion. Well,
Yeah.
now we know
Now we know.
we have a different field on which to practice.
Well, I think I really appreciate those reasons for hope, and just like images, just the way you say, I saw this and it gave me hope, and I saw, and I'll end by saying your book gave me hope. It still does. I'm looking forward to having conversations about it with friends and a little book club. And I'll just end with what's in my mind right now is the company your book offers. I think it's Reynolds Price. Reynolds Price is a Duke professor who became ill and writes about his illness. And there are so many places of company in this book, but there's also that call to think better, speaking about people like Eddie Hillesum and others. So thank you so much for your contribution, for taking the time to have this conversation with me. For your company, for your writing, not to just, keep praising you, but you had many people, I'm sure. It's just You're such a beautiful writer as well. I love when I can read something and I like the sentences as well as the book. And that's there too. So thank you so much for your time and God's blessing in your work and writing from here. Thanks so
It's been
much.
my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me, Todd.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it, Rick. Take care.
Rector's Cupboard is a production of Reflector Project and is hosted and produced by Todd Weeb, Allison Williams, and Amanda Mina. Our cupboard master is Ken Bell. Rector's Cupboard is made possible by the generous support of donors. Check out rectorscupboard.ca for past episodes, events, and how you can help fund the podcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, which helps other people find us. Thanks for listening.